Welcome to The Lob by These Football Times, the home of long-form storytelling online. Let us loop you through the ages of football. So sit back, learn, and enjoy the podcast.
Welcome to These Football Times. This is The Lob Podcast. Today we've got sort of an internal podcast, I guess you'd call it. Three senior writers for These Football Times. We've got myself, Jim Hart, your host. We've got a longtime senior writer, Mr. John Townsend. And we've got one of our newer senior writers, Mr. Juan Arango. What started the idea for this week's podcast was Juan and I were in Panama a couple weeks ago at the Under-17 CONCACAF tournament, and we were having a conversation with Raul Gutierrez from Mexico, Mexican legend, and Juan sent out an interesting tweet. And so, Juan, why don't you kind of talk to us a little bit about that tweet that you sent out and some of the reactions, and then we'll get John involved in this conversation.
Hey, what's up, guys? Glad to be here. But overall, it wasn't necessarily what he said. It was a combination of what he and many others have said throughout. I've had a relationship with a lot of individuals that have been more on the technical side of football and trying to study the different aspects and different trends of different tournaments throughout CONCACAF and some even throughout FIFA as well. And I've talked to a lot of them, and they've said, you know what, man, sometimes what I hear on television about statistics are sometimes things that are just really have the capability of being misconstrued and having a lot of difficulty really understanding and really ascertaining. And especially now, when you have a lot of people that are more involved in metrics and more involved in the analysis of data instead of the analysis of what actually goes on the pitch, I don't think the statistics are necessarily something to really go by from an overall standpoint. There's other factors that need to be mentioned. And of course, we continue discussing things. And what ends up happening is that, you know, they're saying, well, at times in television, you just hear, you know, commentators and analysts saying the same statistics over and over and over again, and using that as their analysis as far as the game, how it's progressing and how everything evolves throughout a match. And there's a bit more to it than that. And then we start talking about things such as positioning. What do the statistics really mean? What does the actual statistic really tell you about the game or doesn't tell you about the game? Just a whole slew of things that really came up, and I thought it was interesting. And of course, the tweet that I put out really got some people riled up. But then when I asked why, many really didn't give a clear, concise reason as to why they thought that way, and then why are statistics so important in one way or another.
It's a fascinating conversation to me because, you know, as everyone knows, I'm not a coach or a former player or anything else, but I do study the game quite closely. And so for me, it's really fascinating. And so when these conversations happen, I get really interested and I learn a lot. And so for me, it's great, right? And I forgot to mention that Juan is the one of the TV announcers for CONCACAF, so I apologize for not introducing you properly. But
you can call me worse. I mean, I've heard worse.
My breakfast buddy, you know. Let's bring John into this. John, of course, is a senior writer at These Football Times. He runs Far Post Footy. He's coach extraordinaire. What else are you, John?
Oh, Jim, thanks for the kind words. I'm a new dad. I'm a fan of the game more than anything, to be honest. I'm a consumer of the game, and I try to put myself in a fan's perspective. And when Juan sent that tweet out, I immediately agreed with him, because as someone who played at a relatively high level in perspective, not globally, just for the American audience, we always talk about these things, and I work in the industry, Jim, in the same industry as you, and our day jobs is, you know, in data science and analytics and deep analytics. And it's really easy to get caught up in the numbers. And what I saw when people took offense to what Juan tweeted, I actually noticed that they were, like, offended personal level because they didn't have the experience or backup, their lack of experience, or they didn't have that playing new and they didn't have that ability to really split hairs. And what I really thought was, you know, you can't discredit experience, and you can't frame things solely in objectivity. Sometimes you have to be subjective, like what Juan's saying, positioning, and you have to measure the intangibles, and these things aren't measurable. You can't measure creativity. You can't measure decision-making all the time. And what we really have is an argument, which, I mean, I wholeheartedly am always going to take the player coaching side. I am not going to be the data scientist today because I don't necessarily believe that this is like Moneyball. Everyone looks at Billy Beane and the Moneyball model and that movie, and they really want to compare that to world football, and it's not possible in my perspective. Now, there are some certain elements that you can definitely expound upon, and we'll get into that. But what we're really talking about is what goes on a data sheet versus what doesn't or what can't go on a data sheet. And I think that at the end of the day, the people who are most offended by it have the least experience of, either playing or coaching, or they're just, they want to interject themselves into the conversation at a level that I felt they made it about them, and I think that they felt that because they didn't play in a World Cup or they didn't play at a high level, that they felt that it was about them. It really wasn't. I mean, sometimes stats, we have so many armchair analysts, so many fans that think they know what possession means. They think they know shots on target or whatever. And some of the most coaches you talk to say that those mean nothing. Those really mean nothing. And you have to look at game models and get really into it to really pull the figures from the statistics. But if we rely only on those things, we're actually going down a road where, it is about people who are just looking at spreadsheets and computer screens and not about the actual game on the field.
What I found fascinating was, beyond this discussion, was the Xabi Alonso piece that came out. I think it was last week sometime. I know you read it, John. I don't know if you read the Xabi Alonso piece, Juan, or not. But mm-hmm. He talked so much in that piece about intelligence being, something like 80 or 90% of football. And, mm-hmm. Game presence and IQ, football IQ being the thing that needs to be addressed so much in today's game. What do you think about that, Juan? And did you read that article?
No, I unfortunately didn't. But I mean, I can really give you an example, just more on a local, on a more national level, what happened last week. I happened to be calling the match between Miami FC and Indy 11. There was a moment where there was a free kick. And again, one of those former, upcoming and young stars of U.S. soccer program and Ben Spies turns in the other direction and kind of loses his reference as to who he has to mark. All of a sudden, one of the Miami FC players opens himself up on the set piece, people expecting a ball to be served over everyone's head and into the area. Instead, it goes short, goes into the middle, crossed in, and Miami FC take the lead 1-0. That took a lot of football IQ because it took the recognition of finding a player and being able to understand how the opposing team is defending you to be able to make the best decision possible. If that ball is sent into the area, usually what's going to happen is the defense is going to knock it away and they come back or whatever play kind of, stagnates and whatever. But there was a recognition that the defense is falling asleep. The defense fell asleep. You take advantage of what they give you and you take it full advantage and take the lead eventually. That was a very, you can check it out on YouTube and you'll see how that played out. But going back to say football IQ, malandraging, street smarts, however you want to look, maliciousness, that's the little bit of edge that really can't be, as John mentioned, it can't be measured. You can't measure how a player is dribbling when he's just looking straight down and going forward and barreling through people instead of looking up and trying to distribute the ball properly. There's a player that had 95%, accuracy in his passes. Okay, who was he passing it to? Was it always forward? Was it always backward? Was it, just little, 2 feet passes? Is it just, long distance passes over everyone's head? Or, those stories aren't the ones that are being told. That's right now what is lacking in football. And kind of doesn't tell the story of how a player is being influential or not based on how he has the ball. Nobody can really tell you you know, how a play is developed because of a person running down the wing and being able to break his marks and making it easier for passes to break lines to be able to make a difference and really fluster defenses. Is that being measured? No, it's not. So how can you tell me that it's based on the amount of shots and based on the amount of corner kicks that's really going to tell you a story over how a player's positioned or not positioned on the pitch?
That's an excellent point. And to follow up on that, when you and I were in Panama, we saw some really good examples of that. And I know we're kind of focused on American stuff right now, and we have a lot of listeners who are not in the U.S., but I hope you'll be patient with us listeners. You know, a story broke today about a player that we know well here in the U.S., Josh Sargent, who is going to be going to Werder Bremen. And he stood out in the under-17 tournament you and I were at because he had that awareness. And I'd like you to talk about the reason that he stood out so much in the tournament at, you know, at the 17s level, and, you know, played with his head up and things like that. You know, talk about that a little bit, Juan.
I could talk about it, but I think we have to first of all talk about how that was more instilled in him. At that point, I have to defer, and I would have to let John talk about that because he's had personal experience with him, and he's one of those individuals that had a lot to do with influencing them in having that vision or that wherewithal within the pitch to know where to run to, know how to be able to be so opportune. I mean, there was a goal that Sargent scored in the under 17 tournament where he, you know, just shadowed the defender. It was a match against Jamaica, shadowed the defender. And waited for the moment where the defender kind of looked to shield him. He moved in the opposite direction. Sargent turns around and pokes the ball from between them. The ball is being, you know, played between the defender and the goalkeeper. The goalkeeper takes a little bit of time to come out. Sargent is able to go, just get enough room to be able to stick his leg through, pokes the ball right through, and scores a goal. So, I mean, that shows you a little bit of football IQ there. In the score sheet, all it's going to appear as a goal for Josh Sargent. But if you saw how that played out and how he was able to manufacture that whole situation, you start seeing that he's just a different player. I mean, you saw him and you touched the ball two or three times and he was a different player out on the pitch. But I think I'd rather hear from John as far as the how that was established more than anything else.
No, I mean, the thing about a player like Josh and players like him is that we see them throughout the years, and there's so few of them that we actually produce or that we find. Maybe we don't even produce them at all. We put them in high environments, and with Josh's development and again, players like him, you always measure as a coach. This isn't necessarily a statistic, but you measure the quality of the players that they're playing with and against, and that's really important to have both those elements. So we like to grade players. An A-grade player would be like a Josh Sargent, or even maybe even better than Josh. Maybe he's an A-minus B-grade, and then you know, C would be, you know, your average, and D would be just a squad player. And you take an American player, and you wonder how many reps has he received, how many minutes has he received at that A grade? So, like, is he receiving passes from A grade players or from D grade? So if he's receiving them from D grade players, he's going to look great, right? Or he's going to look terrible because they're playing to the wrong foot, they're playing behind them, they're playing, you know, overshooting the ball, whatever. And so with Josh, it's really important, and players like him, to give him opportunities to play with players that will make him elevate his game. And that's exactly what happened with his development. Is he was always playing in environments that he was challenged, where he was able to you know, make decisions that aren't necessarily measurable, be creative when need be, but also rely on instinct, rely on the ability to claw his way into situations, fight for that position and a corner kick to free himself to get the header off, to create that pocket of space, drop in between the lines, turn, and then be clinical. And I think what we see is, you know, a whole bunch of elements at play here, and none of them are really something that you're going to find on in a statistic. None of them are going to be able to be measured because, and even if they were, I mean, this is really important for people to understand, even if these were measurable, the audience would not understand what to do with that level of data. And I think that, and Jim, you understand this as well, is the raw data that comes out from some of these data scientists in sports and analytics and all that stuff, that's really hard data. That's, you have to sift and cull through that. And I think so much of the soccer audience, world football audience, especially on social media, they get caught up in that stuff. And they don't really look at the game in terms of what's happening off the ball. And, you know, you have to look no further than, you know, the U17 level, a really raw level where you see players, you know, moving in different areas, floating. They don't look dangerous, and all of a sudden they pop in nowhere and they have the ball on their foot and they're in on goal. Or they disappear for a little bit and then they pop between the lines and all of a sudden the ball's at their foot and they already know where the next play is going to go. They have their head up. They're playing two steps ahead of everyone else. And again, a player like Josh, he's always had the ability to play one or two steps ahead of the game. He plays within himself too. And that's another big thing. He doesn't try to do too much. He drifts, he fades in, he fades out, you know, and again, something that we can measure is something that we would like to, you know, consider the 7-to-1 movements. I think it's in the Premier League that they started doing this at the academy level, which for every one touch a player gets, there's 7 movements to break free to find space that you don't see, that you're not looking. The check two, check away, the drifting, the fading behind the defender's shoulder, coming in again. He may run 7 or 8 times sprinting or doing something, and he may never even get the ball. But then that one time he does, he's worked 7 or 8 times to get to that position, and we don't measure that. And I think, you know, with Juan's experience with the discussion he had with, you know, former professional players, that's what they're talking about. They're talking about those things that no one else is looking at because they don't know to look for it. And I think we talk about the audience and their ability to understand what someone's saying who has high-level elite playing experience, coaching experience, that's what we're talking about. We're not talking about shots on target or expected goals, XG. We're not talking about those things. We're talking about the things that really do make the game up. You look at this, you know, football in the streets or in the Cruyff cages in Holland or in the Barrio. You don't see people caring about how many shots someone took. They're talking about decisions. Decision making is a skill. Scanning is a skill. And these are things that you really don't see measures for. And again, if we did see them, I don't think that our footballing consuming culture is at the maturity to understand what to do with that raw data.
Yeah, no, you're right, John. I mean, that plus player associations, because I mean, when you start to see it from a different lens, you start looking, oh, that's why this team's running rampant on the left-hand side. Oh, that guy's gotten tired. He's not marking. He's staying in the middle. He's not coming out and meeting, you know, and converging when the opposing team's attacking. Or, well, yeah, they're not moving forward. Well, because the two guys on the far side, well, they're not really connecting. There's really no associations going on. That's what, you know, what you're looking at. And when you start talking about shapes too and saying, oh, you know, they're triangulating, they're moving the ball forward, they're moving the ball backward just to be able to, they take one step back or take 2 or 3 forward. And people are like, wait a second, what are you talking about? What do you mean? I just see the guy passing it back and they pass it forward and they take it backwards and forwards. But you know, football is not just a vertical, it's not a vertical sport. It's not just going forward like American football is to a majority of its extent or of its essence. Football, you have to go back maybe 10, 15 yards. You have to try and go back to be able to get a little bit more clarity, see where you're going to send the next ball to. I mean, you don't, those are things that need to be mentioned more. And I think we as communicators need to be more adamant about it. Need to say, hey, this is the reason why I have to drop back, because they're clogging the middle, because this player has no outlet, because of the way they're being marked, or just because of the guy's position 5 yards forward compared to 5 yards back when he was in the first half. Now he's a little bit higher up, then that kind of messes up the passing lanes in the middle. You know, those types of things that appear in video. It doesn't appear anywhere else. It doesn't appear on the stat sheets. It doesn't appear in those types of things. And that, at least when I'm doing commentary, I like to point that out so people understand the why of things instead of just like what's going on.
Yeah, well, and I want to touch on that real quick, because that's really important. You educating the audience, because I'll go on a limb, because I think that a lot of our commentators, some of them are former players, former professionals. They do know this stuff, but they don't ever bother to mention it because, oh, I don't know why. But I think that element, the intangibles, the measuring of or taking stock of things that we aren't measuring, you know, the decision making, that stuff has, from a commentary standpoint, that I think that educates the audience in so many different levels, because now, you know, they may not be looking where the ball's at. They're looking at the runs off the ball. They're looking at the movement, the shift of formation. And you watch, you talk to a lot of fans of Italian football or even German football or Spanish football, like they're looking at the tactical side of things, the shifts off the ball. And for the American audience, I'm not sure. I know we're not really there yet. And I think the American game is a bad example of trying to learn that stuff. But we can also, you know, really take stock in some of the things that you're doing that, and this is a testament to your work. I mean, it's not just, you know, that you're saying it, but you're saying it consistently. And I think that, you know, when we look at, again, you talk commentating at the U17 level in CONCACAF, that's a great level because you're looking at these players implement things that we've tried to teach them at the youth level. And now they're trying to do it, deploy at the national team level, at the youth national team level, which is really important because that's the first time we're actually going to see how good the trajectory of a lot of these players and teams is going to be. And it shows you how good the coaching was or wasn't prior to their arrival at that level. So I just want to touch on that. That's a really good point.
Yeah, I mean, it's all of those things. And I mean, you can learn from the American game. And what I do a lot of times is what they're not doing. You know, well, you know, the guy is, you know, so-and-so gets the ball and it takes him five touches to collect it before he sends that pass into the middle to be able to connect with his teammate who's running. That's why he's offside, not because he doesn't know how to beat the offside trap or he doesn't know how to anticipate. It's because he makes his run, his timing's there, but it's the other teammate that loses it because it takes him five or six touches just to collect the ball, another one to be able to look up, and the seventh one to send it through. I mean, it's a lot of those things. It's about sometimes being able to teach based on what they don't do, based on what they're not doing, based on what they don't have, that people get a better sense of what's going on as well. So, I mean, those are tools that you can use as a counter-reference, because then if they see the same thing happening in the Champions League or in La Liga or in the Premiership, then they say, oh, now I get it. You know, they can have that aha moment, you know, when they're watching and maybe I'm not, you know, doing commentary, or maybe you're not tweeting what you're tweeting, or maybe, you know, they're not reading whatever Jim has written. That they have that moment that they say, oh, I get it now. I understand. Now I see what they're saying. And I think that's something that we as communicators are failing to do on a consistent basis.
I only understand Catenaccio, man.
No, but there's an art to Catenaccio, though. I mean, people, to me, it's more about understanding. I mean, watching Juve defend, to give you more of a modern reference, to see how they defend and how they overlap and how they relay each other, and how difficult it is to find spaces despite Bonucci going in one direction, Chiellini going in another, and you see all these players rotating back and forth and being able to make themselves so versatile defensively. That's something to behold, but that's not something that's really appreciated, or it's not very aesthetically pleasing to people. They want to see Barcelona knocking the ball around here and there and everywhere, but yet they don't see the defensive effort that's being made in order to shut those types of teams down. So that's why, oh, yeah, well, they're parking the bus. No, it's not necessarily parking the bus. You have to understand the intricacies of it. And you, Jim, watching Italian football in Serie A, you understand that a little bit better. You understand the technicalities behind it. I spoke to Alessandro Nesta about that before. And what he's been saying is that, you know, it's tough at times to make that transition, to have them understand those Catenaccio-like concepts and want players to think at a higher level. And I'll mention that later, but it was interesting to hear him say that about having players think at a higher level.
Well, I don't think there's any better league to watch if you want to understand tactical football than Serie A, because it very much is on display in Serie A. To me, the English Premier League is a lot of physicality. There's a lot of excitement, a lot of big names, but the tactics aren't as much in display. I mean, maybe you'll call me out for bullshit there, John, but I don't know. But
well, no, I mean, you think about that. No English manager has won the Premier League. A British manager wasn't Sir Alex, but I mean, other than that, it's been, you know, managers from other countries who are coming from Italy, coming from, you know, I mean, there's something to this, right? There's, maybe I'm wrong. I don't think an English manager has won the Premier League. Someone fact check me, but your point is pretty valid. I mean, the Premier League is entertaining. Don't get me wrong. It's entertaining. It's really well covered, whatever. But if you really want to see that chess match, that ability to see teams adjust on the fly, to counter each other, and not just counterattack, but counter each other's tactics, negate each other's tactics, you have to look at the continent. You have to look at South America. You have to look at Central America. You have to look at some of the things that, you know, where the game is valued in the intangibles. And it's funny, when I look at the Premier League, and I'm a fan of it, and I see the halftime stats, it's all this, like, shots on goal, yellow card, possession. You know, to me, possession means nothing. That's such that probably is the biggest statistic that annoys me, because is possession where? Possession along the back four? You know, that doesn't mean anything to me. Is it possession in the attacking half? Is it possession after a regain? So, like, how long did it take them to regain possession? That's a good stat. You know, so I think, like, people who are really, you know, trying to understand the game, it's all about nuance. And I think the Premier League is a bad example. Honestly, you know, I love it, but it's also the worst example of tactical fluidity, because you look at the managers who are great in the Premier League, they don't come from England. I mean, there's definitely been some successful ones for sure, but I think, you know, you look at Antonio Conte, like what he's done. You look at, you know, even Mourinho, what he's done, and people call it, you know, I'm one of them who says it's anti-football, but just pragmatic. He just understands the role and what the other team is bringing to the table, and he counters it with, you know, whether it's strangling what they're doing or doing something differently. Yeah, and it's an identity. But yeah, I think when we talk about the Premier League, it is becoming a very entertaining league, but it's not what I would tell my players to go watch to learn something about their own position.
Well, you have to look no further than today's Europa League final. I believe the statistics were nearly 70% possession by Ajax.
Mm-hmm.
With absolutely no, I mean, very few shots on goal.
Exactly. I mean, this is an Ajax team that was, I was singing their praises because I love Ajax and I love the Dutch model and I love that they're playing basically a U23 team. But I love that the fact that they interchange and they're playing this total football style and they're doing all the stuff. But then, you know, you go up against a team like Man United, who's got star power, they've got experience, they've got Mourinho as a coach, and he can strangle that out of him, you know. And again, is it aesthetically pleasing for people who love free-flowing football? No. But is it effective football? Yes. Is it good coaching? Absolutely. And I think, you know, Man United fans are some of the most ardent critics of Mourinho, because he has effectively killed the wing play, the attacking wing play that Sir Alex Ferguson built that team on, that club on. And he's like, you know, we're going to be more pragmatic. We're going to use Fellaini as a playmaker. We're not, you know, it's really interesting to see the shift. But yeah, Jim, you're exactly right. 70% possession. The only thing Ajax couldn't do was shoot. And, you know, and they got scored off a deflection and then I think a dead ball and some shoddy defending. But the reality is Mourinho had an answer, Ajax, and maybe it's their youth, and I'm sure it is, that played a factor, but he had a masterclass of coaching and winning a final. It was a great, great display of pragmatic football.
Yeah, I mean, there's no other way to put it. I mean, when you have players that have experience in these types of environment, I mean, a final has a totally different environment. You know that's the end of the road. That's the last match. That you have to have a different mindset. And Mourinho offered that different mindset for United. There's just no two ways about it. I mean, when you're capable of making a match more of a grappling encounter, where, you know, it's more ground and pound than anything else, That favors a team like United, and you end up kind of evening things out, because you're not only just limiting, you're also neutralizing a lot of the best effect or a lot of the best qualities of an Ajax team or whatever team. I mean, you know, there's a reason how and why Mourinho also won the treble with Inter with a very similar style of play, and he also got killed at Real Madrid because of playing that a very similar style, more of a counterattacking than anything else, with, you know, the roster that he had at that team. That being said, you know, when the trophies start coming in and the results are being shown, very few people can argue of his effectiveness, and that's really what it came down to.
Well, there's no question that, you know, if you had to choose one manager and you had one match to play, a lot of people would select Jose Mourinho. But not a lot of people would select him as, you know, the guy you'd want for a whole season or to rebuild a club or whatever. But, you know, I'm kind of,
I mean, but he's done that too. I mean, he's rebuilt it. Maybe not the way we would imagine, you know, having a club rebuilt or at least just not necessarily rebuilt, but amplified when he took over Chelsea the first time around. I mean, that team, for the most part, had already most of those pieces in place already when Claudio Ranieri was the coach. But when he took over, of course, they brought in more faces, and he was able to perfect it. He was able to amplify the potential. And again, it comes out to execution. How do you define with numbers who out-executed who? Because in football, at the end of the day, you can talk about running, you can talk about shooting, scoring, everything. Who out-executed who at the end of the day? And there's still not a statistic for that.
Of course not. And I think that's what we all agree on, is there's no set of statistics, that no formula you can put together, no algorithm to say, this is a winning team. If you run this algorithm through a computer, you will have a winning team. And I think,
trying to find an algorithm for football and who, you know, out execution, like trying to find an algorithm for love. I mean, that's a very subjective thing. I mean,
I'd like to have that one.
Yeah, I mean, because what John was saying about possession, I remember working with Ray Hudson one time, and during a break, you know, I'm talking, yeah, you know, look at this statistic. This looks interesting. Possession without penetration is like playing with yourself. And he's right.
That sounds like Ray. But,
yeah, I mean, he says it, you know, we're off air, of course, and a couple of years later, I decided to use it on Jamaican national television, and people wanted to hang me, as soon as they understood what I was talking about, they got it, but of course, I had to steal that phrase from Ray, and almost ended up getting lynched for it. But I mean, it's true. I mean, there's really no algorithms for football. I mean, football's always been a subjective people's type of sport. So when you start adding statistics, now, mind you, I'm not saying I'm against statistics. I mean, there's certain, you know, and you guys are more savvy, especially you, Jim, about certain numbers that can tell you more about a player's performance and why it's declining with every minute. I mean, things like oxygen output and heart rate and things that are a lot more sophisticated, way more sophisticated than corner kicks and shots on goal.
Well, of course, but it's all in the analysis, right? So you can collect every statistic there is, every single statistic, and you can have the biggest database in the world. But the person who does the analysis is the critical point. And that person has to understand what they're looking at. So, yes, you can say, I've got Fernando Torres at Atletico de Madrid, right? And his key performance indicators, or KPIs, are that he can only play X number of minutes effectively. And after that, his performance starts to drop. He's not running as fast, he doesn't make as many effective cuts, things like that. That comes down to analysis. And I believe that's an effective use of statistics. But, you know, if you start talking about, you know, possession and just use general statistics, I think you're barking up the wrong tree. That's my opinion.
And I agree. I mean, I think, Jim, and, you know, you'll appreciate this term. It's data exhaust, right? These data lakes. All this stuff, it creates, it's noise, right? And I think we look at football statistics, and it creates a lot of feedback, right? And it's I think people are taking a stop-start game like American football, baseball, basketball, and they're trying to apply methodologies and algorithms to a fluid game, a global game with different types of cultures and different types of nuance and intricacies that really aren't measurable. And even if they are measurable, that measure isn't indicative of success versus non-success. And I think, you know, I always use the analogy of, you know, your smartphone or your heart rate monitor. It's going to send feedback into systems all over the place. And you only need one or two of those measures. And what you do with those measures is the value. And I think so much of the noise around this debate is centered on people who want all their collectors of data, but they don't know what to do with it. It's data exhaust. It's all it really comes down to. And I think again, possession is such a great example. I think maybe Diego Simeone might have been the best example, or even Claudio Ranieri. These teams are winning games with 29% possession. So what does possession tell us? More possession is the best thing, is end all be all? No. Again, and then you look at those teams, though, the possession when they did have it, that 29%, where was the most of that possession? Maybe 70% of that 29 was in the attacking half off counterattacks. That's when you start looking at, okay, that's a metric I can use. That's a metric that really makes sense to me. And I don't think the average football fan understands that. I don't think they can value that. And again, certain clubs use something called initiatives or passes that break lines. That's what they measure. They don't measure how many times you pass it to between center backs or between right back and center back or safely 10 yards away. That doesn't matter. It's how many times did you break a line, beat somebody with a vertical pass. I think that's a good use of statistics. But again, I don't think that the audience that really has issues with this whole debate understands that. Maybe I'm selling them short, but I don't think I am, because I've been in the trenches. As a coach, I've been in the trenches as a fan, just trying to understand why people are so up in arms about this. And I think the same people that are up in arms about this really don't understand some of the things that we've been talking about. Because, you know, we can look at the methods and Jim, you hit it on the head. You know, that feedback and the person conducting that feedback, that's the linchpin. That's the really important person. And so often we listen to people who have never ever been to a game. They've never watched a game. They're just looking at, you know, it's like Football Manager. I think we have a bunch of Football Manager, FIFA playing people who are trying to be have valid opinions on their game in real time in real life. And I think that's a big problem. And I have no problem saying that, because I see it all the time. I see people enter discussions without the expertise or without the experience or the willingness to learn and concede their point because they've played a video game or they've just been on Twitter. And I think that's a lot of what we're talking about here.
Well, John, one of the guys I've talked to, and I won't reveal who it is because he doesn't want me to, talks about game theory, and he talks about the use of filled free space polygons. And so what free filled space polygons are is when you take the attacking side and you put points on a plane where the attacking players are, and if you have filled free space polygons to fill up a point where the players are in the attacking zone, that's positive impact. And so they measure the area where there's positive impact, and they give it a grade. And they use game theory to attack that. And it's like, okay, I get that, but now we're getting into some really scary shit.
And yeah, you start freaking me out when you start talking about that.
But that's what these guys in data science are doing, right? And so, but they're using that and they're saying, okay, now how do we take that technology and that analysis and how do we get that to a player's brain, right? And that's where football IQ gets improved. And so how does the player keep his head up and say, okay, I need open space between myself and my players, and how do I create that space without a defender getting in between me? And that's the ultimate result.
Absolutely, and I think a lot of what people misconstrue as statistics and the collection of deep analytics is we're actually measuring paradoxes. We're trying to find out where the irregularities are and why they occur. So when you talk about football, yeah, that's important, but we really want to see the opposite side. We want to see the consistencies and we want to limit the paradoxes. And I think, you know, again, we're getting down a road that I feel like I'm at work now talking to people with PhDs. But the reality is the average football fan and the person who really is consuming the game that maybe Juan's talking to, who's listening to him on air or we talk to on social media or whatever, who reads my articles and reads Juan's articles and Jim's articles, these people, I think they need to have an appreciation for the nuance. And again, if you are someone who likes to look at statistics in the American sporting sense, I challenge you to look at possession, for example. in terms of one more level. Okay, so if you're really going to harp on statistics, look at possession after a lost possession. So how long does it take to regain that possession? Is it 6 seconds on average? And this gets down to what I consider nerd territory, really. And I'm happy to be part of that, but I'm really, at my core, I'm a player's coach. And I think I love data. I work with it all day. But at the end of the day, I'm more about the stuff that we can't measure. And again, in recent times, I've referenced Arsene Wenger and when he first arrived in England, what he used to do. And yeah, he brought some nuance and some data with him, and he revolutionized the English game. But he also talked about maturity and decision making and things outside of the football club and things like that. And I think that's where we really need to spend our time trying to understand, or maybe not even understand, just appreciating. Because I think some of these things you cannot understand, in my opinion.
I agree. And Juan, you were about to say something, but before you do, I think I'm going to quote your original tweet. Stats are for nerds.
Well, they are. They kind of are. I mean, if you look at it from that perspective, they are for nerds. Now, let me make an amendment there. If you know how to use them intelligently, they're not for nerds. If you understand which statistics to use and which statistics to use appropriately, then no, it's not for nerds. If you're just going to go in and wildly throw, and I've had that criticism of a lot of commentators that use stats as crutches. And what I've meant by crutches is, well, yeah, but they're still shooting on goal. I'm like, yeah, but the shot that they're taking is getting knocked out of the stadium. I mean, how is that influencing, the outcome of the game? At least from their perspective, it's really having no influence at all. The defense that has any logic is like, fine, you're going to shoot from out there. It's going to go, you know, into the parking lot. Take it all day. We're more than happy to do it. You know, we're more than happy to be able to give those types of opportunities up. Who wouldn't be? But you also have to understand the context in certain statistics and when to not use it and say, hey, you know what? This guy is not in position. The shape of the back line is not in position. You look at the shape between the or look at the distance and the spacing between the midfielders and the defenders. They're like 2 inches between, you know, in front of each other. And that's why you have so much trouble, you know, sending the ball up forward, and there's really no continuity, no fluidity to play. That's what I prefer to talk about instead of using statistics. Now, statistics to support a particular argument, that's something different. That's something where you need to go and say, yeah, you see why they have 90% possession but no shots on goal, because the defense is going up, but yet the other team has 10%, and the few touches they've had, they've gone straight to goal and they've scored. That's what tells you what the outcome of the match is. If you're able to use one or two, maybe three different statistics to tell a story, that's totally different. But to say, well, yeah, so, you know, John's team is doing a better job because they passed the ball around 789 times out of a possible, you know, and were accurate on 786 of them. You know, they have 99% passing accuracy. Well, yeah, but, you know, the guys are like 2 feet from each other. How can you not miss a pass? You know, so it tells you a lot of those things. And yes, stats are for nerds, but if you know how to use them properly, they can be for everyone.
So do you think the great Barcelona teams that pass the ball and I'm going to use the tiki-taka word, you know, but mm-hmm. do you think they ruined everyone into using statistics?
No, they didn't. It wasn't them. They were, I mean, Andres Iniesta was interviewed a few years back about that. And he's like, you know, that is our pragmatism. We don't have fast players. We don't have players that can just burn past everyone. We don't have super fast wingers, or, you know, I'm not a super fast player. And nobody really at Barcelona was known for being a burner. But so they had to use a style of play that was very indicative and was very appropriate for the players that they had within that club. And it ended up being that. It's not their fault that they played that way.
Yeah, I know.
It ended up changing the way that people played football, but it was more out of pragmatism because of what they had and having skilled players and not very big players to keep the ball on the ground and knock it around as much as possible.
Yeah, I know it's not their fault. And I know Xavi Hernandez was just an absolute mastermind at at moving the ball around. But
of course,
you know, the announcers, right? So they needed a crutch to get through those matches, I guess. Did they take that on and just pile the stats on and just, I mean...
Yeah, to an extent. But what I learned, and this was something that I was told by an Argentine friend of mine that's an announcer down there. He's like, commentate what's away from the ball. Everybody knows that Messi has the ball. Everybody knows that Xavi has the ball. What do I care? I want to see what Dani Alves is doing. I want to see why, you know, they're knocking the ball around. All of a sudden, out of nowhere, Luis Suarez is all open, you know, by himself, top of the 18. Why did that happen? Talk about what's going away from the ball. Don't. Everybody knows who has the ball. You can say, okay, fine, he has the ball, knock it here, knock it there. But what's going on on the wings? You know, why are the you know, the teams pressing up so high? You know, why isn't David Alaba unable to break through? Is it because the right back is pressing, or the right wing is preventing them from moving forward? I mean, tell me about that. Tell me why this is not occurring. Tell me why they're knocking the ball around. They're just going from side to side and not going from goal to goal. I need to know more than that. 66% possession doesn't tell me anything at the end of the day. It's just going to tell me who had the ball more and who really didn't know how to do more with it.
All right, so I have a side question here.
Yeah.
Just for my curiosity, because I want your opinion, Juan, and I want your opinion, John, after that. Is Juventus going to a back four with Dani Alves the reason they're going to win the Champions League next week?
See, Dani Alves with Barcelona, and again, I use that as a reference, was a major factor against Real Madrid in the past. And he did it in different roles. He not only did it as a right back, he did it as a right wing as well. I mean, there's been a couple of matches where Pep Guardiola changed to a 4-1-4-1 formation, put Dani Alves out wide as a right wing, and kind of had, I think it was Carles Puyol who moved over to right back to try and prevent Cristiano Ronaldo from making runs, or trying to prevent whoever was playing on that side to make runs, but also to give Dani Alves the ball a little bit further up and make him a more of an influential player up top. He can do that. So I mean, we'll see how that plays out. But I think it would end up being more of a back line of five if you end up playing around Madrid, just to keep those three central defenders in there to prevent Ronaldo from running in. And again, the wild card there is going to be Karim Benzema, seeing how he performs. That would probably end up being the key difference as to Juventus being able to neutralize Madrid's attack or not. But for me, I'd probably have a back line of five with three center backs and two wing backs out wide.
Mm. John, what's your opinion? That's just my opinion. John?
I think it's less about Dani Alves and more about having ball-playing center backs, to be honest. Guys who are comfortable on the ball, can interchange, can step into the midfield if need be, can defend. Like, yeah, I mean, I wrote an article once on the Calcio issue of, you know, why Italians are take such pride in individual and team defense. I think that's probably more where I would, you know, put my argument. Because, I mean, yes, Dani Alves is going to, you know, streak down the wing if you need be. He's going to be versatile. He's going to be effective, you know, in similar ways as like you see him with Marcelo and, you know, attacking and, you know, with Real Madrid. You know, but I think the ability to control the play from the back, play out of the back if need be, but have guys that are confident on the ball, that can find the players in the midfield, that can hold the ball, turn out, and be composed instead of conceding possession. I think I think this is Juventus either on schedule or already has, I think, the best defense in Champions League history, like this year. I think, I don't know if that's still the case, but they have shown through having ball-playing center backs, guys like Bonucci, that they can really dictate games from the back line. You know, they're not necessarily, you know, you look at some of the best teams in the world. Yeah, you look at their strikers and their midfielders, and I think you value that their center backs do the job. But I rarely ever see, you know, a team's identity for years to come. I think Juventus is going to be stellar with their back line production.
So you think Barzagli plays then?
I do, yeah.
Yeah, I agree. I would see Barzagli playing.
Wow. Yeah. Interesting. Sorry, I had to sidetrack that because I think this is shaping up to be possibly one of the best Champions League finals in quite a while. At least since the Borussia Dortmund Bayern Munich final.
Yeah, good. But again, it's going to come down to what most of the matches in football come down to, which is midfield. And you know who's going to be the who's going to make the difference in Madrid's midfield? Will it be Casemiro holding the midfield, or is it going to be Toni Kroos controlling the ball and knocking it through? Is it going to be Juventus in them as well? Well, I mean, who's going to be, who's going to be the influencer there?
And once again, we're talking about probably, two teams who have football IQ that is just out the roof. I mean, just two of the smartest teams we've ever seen, probably.
Well, right? One of the things that Allegri has said, and this is, no one's picked this up really, but he says this a lot, and it's this defense doesn't rest. So that would be a great metric, is how often is that defense moving when the ball's in the attacking third? You know, like they're always moving, negating, cutting off passing lanes, moving forward, taking usable space away. No one ever notices that, and that's kind of the wants point. Look at what's going on off the ball. Like that's the value. And, you know, he's huge on that. He's huge on, our defenders do not rest. They are working even when we have possession and we're taking shots on goal or we're holding it in their half. Our defense is advancing and shifting and dictating how, even if we do get countered, we're dictating how they're going to counter us. It's not Catenaccio, but it's very close to this trap, right? It's, that ball gets turned over. Now we know what's coming. Unless they really want to test us, if we do get transition, we pop in transition, we know how we're going to get popped in transition. And that's key. And I think that's what Juventus has really shown us this year, is this idea that, the defense is there to win titles. And we saw it with, the legendary AC Milan sides, with how their central defenders really were the spine. But this Juventus team has shown me, at least, just how active the defense is off the ball when no one's looking. That's when I think that people need to really take notice, and there's a lot of value in that.
Well, Juan, I saw your friend George Di Mateus the other night say that that Marcelo was Real Madrid's MVP this year.
Of course, no doubt. And not because George said it; it's because many in Spain have seen that. I mean, just look at some of the toughest matches that they've had. Who's a player that's emerged? It's been Marcelo. He's been the playmaker for Real Madrid in certain aspects of certain stages of the match.
Marcelo's been brilliant. Sergio Ramos, on the other hand, still has the red card problem, but he's the captain. He can do that, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah. Get you a last minute goal. So
yeah, he can do that, right? He can do that. Well, listen, fellas, this has been a truly, truly fascinating hour of talk. Two of my great friends, both guys I love very much. First of all, I'd like to thank Juan for coming on. Juan, why don't you give us a few places we can find you. I know you've got a new venture going with Beyond the Pitch. Why don't you tell us about that a little bit?
Well, yeah, right now I'm doing some work with Beyond the Pitch over at NBC Sports. And it's interesting. I've already had Jefferson Savarino of Real Salt Lake. I just spoke a little while ago to Rod Underwood, who's the head coach of Montego Bay United. A guy that's very well-rounded when it comes to football in the United States. One of the good number of Americans that are abroad. That's a series that I'm starting with Beyond the Pitch, American coaches abroad, and how their experience overseas is helping them out. Rod's just been, a very worldly type of individual. So he's a great guy to talk football with. I have a couple of other guests coming on, so you'll check it out over on Beyond the Pitch. I'll be posting all those articles and all those features as well in the coming weeks. And just talking to people in Spanish, English, in Portuguese as well, you know, having a lot of interviews just to give people a broader scope of how football is seen, not just, you know, in this part of the world, but also around the world. You know, I'm going to have a, you know, guy that was part of the Brazilian national team with in Palinha, who's living up in Boston now, having him in a couple of weeks talking football with me, and you know, great knowledgeable football player that he was, great football player that he was. And, you know, players like those, coaches, all types of stuff like that, just, you know, really next level stuff that we're looking to do over at Beyond the Pitch as far as the type of players and the type of individuals that we're looking to bring in to interview. You can also follow me on Twitter at @JuanG_Rango. You can also, I mean, I do, you know, contributions here and there for, you know, places like Afición Central over in Ecuador. I do some stuff with Al Jazeera. Occasionally I'm on beIN Sports, and of course I'm a color analyst for Miami FC. So, I don't want to take any more time, but just a few of the things that I'm doing right now.
And you can also find a terrific piece on Pep Guardiola in Mexico in the upcoming Mexico edition of These Football Times, the magazine, which is really fantastic. This is the best edition we've done, and it's, I got to tell you, folks, it's going to blow your mind. It's fantastic, and both Juan and John feature in this magazine, and it's the best magazine we've done, without a doubt. And Juan, your article on Pep in Mexico is one of the highlights of the magazine, without a doubt.
I see that the money went through, so yeah, thank you very much. I appreciate it. The wire transfer went through.
Oh, good.
Thank you.
John, where can... besides These Football Times, where you're one of the longest serving members of the staff, where can we find you?
Oh God, when I choose to write and I have the time, farpostfooty.com is my personal just website where I throw some coaching stuff out there, some personal thoughts, some you know, more just insights that I don't necessarily want to hold back on. Obviously These Football Times is something that I do my own little podcast on Far Post Footy, just more just me. I have an article that I've written or a discussion that I've had, and I'll just kind of go 20 minutes and no one wants to hear me talk more, so I keep them short. I'm working on a couple things for These Football Times. One of them is the 93-94 AC Milan season, where they actually scored one more goal, 36 goals, then the relegated Atalanta and Udinese, and they still won the title. So basically illustrating, you know, they only conceded 15 goals all year, and they won the title. So attack wins you games, but defense wins you titles is the theme. I'm starting to write that out, and hopefully it's well received. But other than that, I have a couple other things that I'm really working on, but you know, my book is one of them. I always say that, but I'm finally gonna crack down and get that thing done, because it's the curse and the blessing of my life is having this book that it remains in draft form. I have to do the rewrite now. So that's titled "It's Just the Ball." It's player development type of book. It's a narrative. It's a nonfiction narrative, but it's a something that is gonna be pretty interesting to see how it's received. But I have no date on when that's gonna come out. But I do have a that in the works, so I'll be sure to update everybody when that's getting close. But other than that, no, like, find me on Twitter, John JON_Townsend, TOWNSEND 3. That's where I am most active, and that's all I got.
And I am your host, Jim Hart, which is at Catenacciari. I'll let you figure out how to spell that. As always, Calcio articles are appreciated, John. Please go to thesefootballtimes.co and order the German edition of the magazine, which is on sale now and available for immediate delivery, which is actually dedicated to John's newly born son, Aiden, which you'll find, I think, quite unique. And we have our upcoming Mexico edition, which is available for order now, where you can find both John and Juan have terrific articles in there. We'll have another magazine coming out right before the new season starts in the fall. So for These Football Times and the Lob Podcast, this is Jim Hart signing off. Thanks for listening.